Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. Signos.com with code SPARK. Signos.
People interested in true crime are always baffled by the why. Why would someone do these things? What path in life could possibly have led them to commit such atrocious acts? In this podcast, we aim to explore the upbringings and backgrounds of some of history's worst criminals, but with a twist. Because we want you to set aside what you already know about them, we won't use their names until the end of the show so you can listen anew and hopefully get insight into the question that haunts us the most. Why did they do it? Join us as we explore The Catalyst. It was summertime when a 60-year-old woman named Sybil Ferris met a handsome college student at the yacht club where she served as a pastry chef. He, too, was an employee working as a busboy, just one in a series of menial jobs he'd hustled to put himself through school. Ferris, a widow, found the young man charming, a lovable rascal, she called him. He could talk her into almost anything. The rascal told her stories about his life. His family had been very strict, he explained. He was on his own now, just trying to survive. Sometimes he had nowhere to sleep except in a dormitory lounge, using a key he'd obtained through questionable means. Ferris felt sorry for him. She wanted to help. So she loaned him her car, which he would return in the early morning hours. She also loaned him her best crystal and silver when he wanted to impress girls with a home-cooked meal. He never seemed to hold on to jobs for very long, which Sybil couldn't quite make sense of. He was certainly a smart enough guy. He just seemed too restless, unable to keep himself out of trouble. When one job would fall through, she would invariably help him land another. Once at a nearby Safeway grocery store, though he simply stopped showing up one day without notice. Another time, she got him a gig at a downtown luxury hotel. He only lasted there a month. Other employees suspected he was rifling through their lockers. A suspicion the rascal confirmed for Sybil one day when he showed off a uniform to her that he had stolen. She chalked it up to a boyish prank. Mind you, this boy was 20 years old. But she found him so entertaining, his schemes, his stories. He bragged his father was a famous chef. He said he had an uncle high up in politics. Once he put on a black wig for Sybil, and she delighted in how completely it transformed not just his appearance, but something deeper. He seemed like a completely different person. After a while, Sybil began to notice things, the way the rascal always seemed to be sneaking around. He would take intoxicated customers home from work, something that became more concerning when she heard some of his co-workers suspected he was taking advantage of inebriated customers. Then there was the young secretary he'd brought up to the yacht club's crow's nest, an elevated lookout area, where Sybil suspected him of quote-unquote hanky-panky. Still, she couldn't help but like the young man. When they talked, he really seemed to listen to her. He was intelligent, well-spoken, and almost unnervingly observant. She saw potential in him. She dismissed his apparent indiscretions as just boys-will-be-boys-style antics. Then she loaned him money, a line she would quickly wish she hadn't crossed. She asked and asked, but he wouldn't pay it back. Sybil got so frustrated, she called the rascal's mother, who laughed and said, "You're a fool to loan him money. You'll never get it back." Then came the words that would prove more prophetic than anyone could have imagined. Quote, "He's a stranger around here." end quote. A stranger, even to his own mother. Sometimes the most dangerous people aren't the obvious predators. Sometimes they're the ones who seem to need our help. Years later, when investigators would pore over every detail of the rascal's life, trying to understand how such a charming young man could evolve into something so darkly sinister, they would find themselves returning again and again to his earliest years. Not because his childhood was uniquely horrific, though it definitely had its darkness, but because of how expertly he had learned from the very beginning to construct elaborate lies about who he was. The first lie wasn't even his own. The rascal entered the world in a Vermont home for unwed mothers. His mother was 22 years old and unmarried, a scandal that would shape the first chapter of his life in ways he wouldn't fully understand until he was an adult. Rather than face the social stigma of being an unwed mother in 1940s America, his mother Louise made a decision that seemed practical at the time. She would let her parents raise the boy as their own son, while she would pose as his older sister. It was a deception that would last for years, creating the foundation for a life built on carefully constructed facades. And so, the rascal spent his earliest years living with his maternal grandparents, though to him, they were mom and dad. His mother wasn't his mother. She was his big sister who lived in the same house. It seemed as perfect a solution as they could hope for in such an imperfect situation. But the household harbored other secrets. His grandfather was a man with a violent temper who some family members later described as abusive. He was known to kick dogs and swing cats by their tails. Neighbors whispered about his explosive rages. His grandmother was reportedly so fearful of her husband that she rarely left the house, eventually becoming agoraphobic. Even as a small child, the rascal seemed to sense something was off. He was an unusually quiet boy, watchful in a way that made adults uncomfortable. While other children played loudly and carelessly, he observed, he listened, he learned to read the moods and motivations of the adults around him with an almost preternatural awareness. There were early warning signs that something wasn't quite right with the boy's development. He wet his bed well into his childhood years. Family members would later recall him placing knives around the bed of his sleeping sister, though she would downplay these incidents, insisting they were harmless childhood pranks. When the rascal was 4, his mother made another life-changing decision. She packed up her brother/son and moved across the country to the Pacific Northwest, where relatives lived. There, she would finally reclaim her role as his mother, in practice, though not yet in name. She didn't fully explain the previous arrangement. She simply told the boy that his grandmother, or mother, had been sick and wasn't able to care for him herself anymore. In their new city, his sister mother met a hospital cook willing to marry her and adopt the rascal. It should have been a fresh start, a chance to build a more conventional life. The rascal took his stepfather's surname, and his mother and stepfather went on to have 4 more children together. They became, from the outside, an ordinary working-class family. 2 parents, 5 kids, church on Sundays, camping trips in the summer. But the rascal never warmed to his stepfather. Though the man tried to include him in family activities, he seemed to hold his stepfather in contempt, resenting the man's modest income and lack of refinement. He preferred to imagine himself destined for something greater. Even though the rascal didn't know it yet, the lies of his early years had already taken root. He had learned that the adults closest to him were capable of elaborate deceptions. He had absorbed the lesson that identity was fluid, that you could simply decide to be someone else and make people believe it. Most importantly, he had discovered that he possessed an unusual ability to charm and manipulate the people around him. At school, teachers found the rascal to be exceptionally bright, but somehow hollow. He could mimic the social behaviors expected of him. He was polite, well-groomed, articulate, but there was something missing beneath the surface. Other children seemed to sense it too. He struggled to make genuine friendships, though he excelled at making adults think well of him. As he entered his teenage years, the rascal began to perfect the skills that would later make him so dangerous. What he lacked in natural confidence, he compensated for with observation. He studied his classmates closely, the boys who commanded attention, the girls who seemed to gravitate toward them. He longed for the same kind of approval, but struggled to find it. He learned to present different versions of himself to different people, always showing them exactly what they wanted to see. With teachers, he was the earnest student. With older women, like Sybil Ferris, he was the charming boy who needed rescuing. With his peers, he was harder to pin down, not quite fitting in, but not obviously an outcast either. He also began experimenting with theft. Small things at first. Ski equipment that mysteriously appeared in his possession. Items that went missing from stores where he worked. When confronted, he had an uncanny ability to explain away these incidents in ways that made the accusers feel foolish for suspecting him. The most profound discovery of his young life came when he finally learned the truth about his parentage, that the sister who had raised him was actually his mother. He learned this when he traveled to Vermont to get a copy of his birth certificate at age 22, according to the most celebrated book about his life. Not only was his sister's name listed in the mother's spot, but the word illegitimate was reportedly stamped across the document. Rather than feeling betrayed or damaged by this revelation, the rascal seemed to find it almost liberating. It confirmed what he had always suspected, that the most important thing in life wasn't truth, but the ability to control what other people believed about you. By the time he arrived at college and began working at places like the local yacht club, he had already spent years perfecting his greatest talent, the ability to become whoever he needed to be in any given moment. Charming student, vulnerable young man in need of help, respectful employee, rebellious prankster. It was this skill that would make him both irresistible to women like Sybil Ferris and, eventually, absolutely deadly. But that would come later. First, there would be heartbreak. College gave the rascal new opportunities to reshape his identity, and he seized them eagerly. He enrolled at the state university and gravitated toward political science and law, fields that promised not just knowledge, but respectability. Here, finally, was a chance to shed the working-class origins he so despised and become the sophisticated man he believed himself destined to be. He excelled at debate, not because his facts were airtight, but because of his ability to project confidence, to sound authoritative even when he wasn't entirely sure of his ground. Professors noted his persuasive skill and sharp mind. Classmates were split in their reactions, some impressed by his intensity and apparent dedication, others vaguely unsettled by something they couldn't quite name. Beyond academics, the rascal dove headfirst into politics. He volunteered on campaigns, shook hands at rallies, passed out pamphlets, and learned how to work a crowd. He discovered he had a gift for reading people and telling them exactly what they wanted to hear. To casual acquaintances, he looked like a young man clearly on track for a respectable career in law or government. He carefully cultivated that perception. It gave him legitimacy, something concrete to point to as proof of his promise and potential. But it was during this period of apparent success that the rascal encountered the person who would fundamentally alter the trajectory of his life. She walked into his world like something from a different planet. She came from a wealthy California family, carried herself with effortless poise, and embodied everything he had ever wanted. Sophistication, stability, unquestioned social status. When she spoke, people listened. When she entered a room, conversations shifted. She possessed the kind of natural confidence that couldn't be learned or faked. The birthright of someone who had never had to question her place in the world. For the rascal, she represented everything he craved. Wealth, status, elegance, acceptance into circles that seemed forever closed to him. He later wrote of her, quote, "She and I had about as much in common as Sears and Roebuck does with Saks. Never considered her with any more romantic interest than I considered some elegant creature on the fashion page," end quote. In his studies of her, he noticed she preferred jocks, usually of the football variety. But that gave him an in. While he wasn't much for pigskin, he did love to ski, and so did she. He managed to hitch a ride to the mountains and spend a day skiing with her. He found himself infatuated. With her, he felt he could step into the life he had always imagined for himself. And for a short time, they looked the part of an enviable young couple. She introduced him to a world of country clubs, fine restaurants, and the kind of effortless financial ease he had never known growing up in his working-class household. He threw himself into the relationship with calculated intensity, studying her world like he was preparing for an exam. He began modifying his speech patterns, his mannerisms, even his interests to better align with what he thought she expected. But the more time they spent together, the more the cracks began to show. His insecurities leaked out in small ways, exaggerating his achievements, embellishing his background, pretending to be more polished than he was. She wasn't fooled for long. She began to notice the gaps in his stories, the way details changed from one telling to another. When she finally ended things, citing his immaturity and lack of direction, the rascal was devastated. At first, he refused to believe it was over. He tried to win her back, making promises about who he could become. He worked even more desperately to become what he thought she wanted from him, and it briefly worked. She let him back into her life, long enough for him to think he had fixed what was broken. But before long, she left again, this time seemingly for good. The effect was catastrophic. His family and acquaintances would later say he seemed hollowed out, consumed by bitterness. For the rascal, this wasn't just personal heartbreak. This was a public rejection of the identity he had been constructing piece by piece. Without her, he was back to being ordinary, and worse than ordinary, exposed as a fraud. The woman who symbolized sophistication and stability had looked at him closely and decided he wasn't good enough. He had learned a devastating lesson. Admiration was conditional. Respect could vanish with a word. He couldn't control how others saw him, not fully. That loss of control was intolerable. In the aftermath, he spiraled. He dropped out of school, drifted aimlessly, and seemed to lose the drive and focus that had defined his college years. But something deeper and more dangerous was taking root in the ruins of his shattered ego. He became obsessed with the rejection, replaying every conversation, every slight, every moment where he had revealed too much of his true self. The rejection festered inside him, transforming from hurt into something harder and more malevolent. More troubling still, he began to develop a specific type of woman he was drawn to. The same hair color, the same build, the same air of casual confidence. What might look like preference to an outsider was, in reality, an obsession. And behind the obsession was anger. He would spend years perfecting his ability to charm women who looked like her, as though each encounter was a chance to replay the story with a different ending. But eventually, charm would no longer be enough. The heartbreak could have destroyed him. For a time, it seemed like it might. But the rascal possessed something that set him apart from ordinary people. An almost superhuman capacity for reinvention. If she had rejected the person he was, then he would simply become someone else, someone better, someone worthy. What followed was perhaps the most calculated transformation in the annals of human psychology. He returned to school with a focus and intensity that surprised everyone who knew him. Gone was the aimless drifter who had dropped out in despair. In his place was a man with clear goals and the discipline to achieve them. He threw himself into his studies with renewed vigor, determined to excel not just academically, but socially and politically as well. He cultivated relationships with professors, impressing them with his sharp mind and apparent dedication to public service. He volunteered for political campaigns with the kind of enthusiasm usually reserved for true believers. He learned to dress better, speak more eloquently, carry himself with a kind of confidence that opens doors. To everyone around him, it looked like natural maturation, a young man finally finding his direction in life. Only the rascal knew the truth. Every improvement was calculated, every skill developed with a specific purpose in mind. He was rebuilding himself from the ground up, creating the kind of person who could never be dismissed as immature or lacking in direction. The transformation wasn't just external. He studied human psychology with the intensity of a scholar, learning to read people's motivations and desires with almost clinical precision. He practiced charm like other people practice piano, daily, obsessively, until it sounded effortless. In the midst of rebuilding his shattered ego, the rascal found an unexpected outlet for perfecting his new skills: volunteer work at a crisis intervention center. There, he spent long night shifts taking calls from people at their most vulnerable moments, the suicidal, the desperate, the broken. To his colleagues, he appeared patient and compassionate, someone who genuinely cared about helping others through their darkest hours. But for the rascal, the crisis line served a different purpose entirely. It was a laboratory for studying human psychology at its rawest. He learned to read the subtle inflections in a stranger's voice, to identify exactly what someone needed to hear, to project empathy he didn't actually feel. Night after night, he practiced the art of emotional manipulation on people who trusted him completely with their pain. The irony was lost on no one who would later look back on this period. The man learning to save lives by day would soon begin taking them by night. Years passed. The boy who had been crushed by rejection became a man who commanded respect. He was known in political circles, respected by professors, admired by his peers. He looked like someone destined for success, a future lawyer, perhaps a politician, certainly someone who mattered. And through it all, he never forgot her. In the summer of 1973, fate, or perhaps his own careful maneuvering, brought them back together. He was traveling to California on political business when they reconnected. She barely recognized the man who stood before her. Gone was the insecure, grasping boy she had known in college. In his place was someone polished, confident, clearly on the cusp of a significant career. She was intrigued, then impressed, then genuinely attracted to this new version of him. Here was proof that people could change, that the potential she had glimpsed years earlier had finally been realized. When he pursued her, she didn't resist. And why would she? This was exactly the kind of man she had always been drawn to. They began dating again, and this time, things were different. He no longer seemed desperate for her approval or intimidated by her background. He matched her sophistication effortlessly, spoke knowledgeably about politics and law, moved through her social circles with a kind of ease that had once eluded him entirely. She fell for him all over again. They talked about marriage. He introduced her to colleagues as his fiancée. She flew to his hometown multiple times to spend weekends with him, envisioning a future that seemed not just possible, but inevitable. And then, in January 1974, without warning or explanation, it ended. He stopped returning her calls. Her letters went unanswered. When she finally managed to reach him by phone, demanding to know what had happened, his response was delivered in a tone so flat and cold, it seemed to come from a stranger. "I have no idea what you mean," he said, and hung up. It took her years to understand what had happened. This hadn't been a romance that simply ran its course. It had been a performance, years in the making, flawlessly executed, designed for this single moment of perfect revenge. He had transformed himself not out of genuine desire for self-improvement, but to prove a point that he could make her love him again and then discard her even more cruelly than she had once discarded him. The humiliation she had inflicted on him in college had been repaid with interest. But for the rascal, the victory felt hollow. The wound she had opened years earlier remained unhealed, and revenge wasn't the balm he had expected it to be. Soon after, he would seek satisfaction in a very different way.
Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, will this send me spiraling out of my routine?
Time to consult the online experts.
Hi, Felicia here with 1 million followers. That bite will destroy your metabolism.
Is it really that bad? I had protein this morning. Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again? Oh, the kids would really love this.
Insulin sensitivity.
Are we
Stop it.
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at cygnos.com. That's cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Within days of that cold phone call with his ex-girlfriend in January 1974, the rascal, or at least something inside of him, snapped irreparably. Just days after ending his relationship, he crossed a line from which there would be no return. Karen Sparks was 18 years old, a college dance student living in a basement apartment in the city's university district. She'd gone to bed as usual the night of January 4th, and when she didn't appear for breakfast the next morning, her housemates assumed she was sleeping in. They didn't begin to worry until mid-afternoon. They went to check on her, calling her name. No response. Then they approached her bed. The brutality unleashed on her was so vicious, so violent, that even grizzled detectives had trouble with the sight when they reached the scene. Sparks spent 10 days in a coma, emerging with permanent brain damage as well as some hearing and vision loss. She was one of the fortunate ones. She survived. But she had no memory of the attack, no description of her assailant, no way to help police understand what kind of monster had invaded her home. 4 weeks later, the rascals struck again. Linda Ann Healy was 21, a popular student known throughout town for giving weather and ski reports on local radio, a responsibility that required her to wake early and check conditions across the region. On the morning of February 1, 1974, her housemates found her bed carefully made, but blood was on the pillows and sheets. Her nightgown hung in the closet, also caked with blood. Linda was gone, vanished without a trace in the pre-dawn hours. The rascal had entered her bedroom while she slept, knocked her unconscious, dressed her in jeans and a blouse, and carried her away to his waiting car. Unlike Karen Sparks, Linda Ann Healy would never be found alive. Her skull and jawbone would be discovered 13 months later on Taylor Mountain, along with the remains of other young women. A mysterious phone call came to police 3 days after Healy's disappearance. The male caller said, quote, "Listen and listen carefully. The person who attacked that girl on the 8th of last month and the person who took Linda Healy away are one and the same," end quote. The caller's identity was never determined. What appeared to have started as a targeted assault had evolved into something far more systematic and deadly. The rascal had discovered that violence provided a satisfaction that mere psychological manipulation could not. FBI behavioral analyst William Hagmeier, who would later interview the rascal extensively, described his, quote, "deep, almost mystical satisfaction," end quote, in murder. The attacks accelerated with terrifying regularity. In March, 19-year-old Donna Gail Manson disappeared while walking to a jazz concert. Unlike the first two victims, she didn't attend Seattle's University of Washington. Donna was an Evergreen State College student. Her body was never found. In April, 18-year-old Susan Rancor vanished from Central Washington State College. In May, 20-year-old Kathy Parks disappeared from Oregon State University. In June, 22-year-old Brenda Ball went missing after leaving a tavern in Burien. Investigators would later note a chilling pattern. Nearly every victim had long, dark hair parted down the middle. They didn't yet know this was the killer's grotesque homage to the one who got away. The rascal had perfected his approach with disturbing efficiency. Sometimes he would approach potential victims in public places, often feigning an injury to appear harmless and in need of assistance. He used his charm to pick up his victims. His clean-cut appearance and articulate manner disarmed suspicion. Who would suspect such a polite young man, one who said he was a law student, no less, of such horrific crimes? On July 14, 1974, the rascal grew bold enough to hunt in broad daylight at a crowded public beach. At Lake Sammamish State Park, witnesses saw a young man with his arm in a sling asking women to help him load a sailboat. Two women, Janice Ott and Denise Naslund, disappeared that day within hours of each other. The police sketch that resulted from witness descriptions showed a handsome young man with dark hair. The suspect drove a Volkswagen Beetle. Enough people had paid attention to gather that the name he had given his victims was Ted. Multiple people who knew the rascal recognized the description and called police, including his girlfriend Elizabeth Klopfer. But detectives found it hard to believe that a clean-cut law student with no criminal record could be responsible for such savage crimes. The rascal had learned to hide in plain sight, using his carefully constructed facade of respectability as the perfect camouflage. The transformation was complete. The lovable rascal that Sybil Ferris had known was gone, replaced by one of the most dangerous predators in American history. But his killing spree in Washington was only the beginning. In August 1974, the rascal was accepted to law school at the University of Utah. He told friends and family he was pursuing his dream of becoming a lawyer. In reality, he was simply moving his hunting grounds. The killings continued with methodical precision throughout Utah. Young women disappeared from shopping malls and college campuses. But by 1975, the rascal had grown bolder, expanding his operations into Colorado. His methods were also growing more violent. In January, 23-year-old nurse Karen Campbell simply vanished while walking down a brightly lit hotel hallway in Snowmass Village. Her body found a month later, bearing the distinctive marks of blunt force trauma to her skull. In March, he approached ski instructor Julie Cunningham in Vail, using his perfected ruse of appearing injured and asking for help carrying his ski equipment to his car, where he clubbed and handcuffed her before driving her to a remote location for sexual assault. In April, 25-year-old Denise Liverson disappeared while bicycling near Grand Junction. The rascal later admitted to killing her in his car and dumping her body in the Colorado River. The geographic range was expanding, the violence escalating, and his confidence in his ability to evade capture had grown dangerously high. That confidence would prove to be his downfall. In August 1975, a Utah Highway Patrol officer pulled over a Volkswagen Beetle behaving suspiciously in a residential neighborhood. Inside, he found burglary tools, handcuffs, an ice pick, and a ski mask. The driver was polite, articulate, and had a perfectly reasonable explanation for everything. But something didn't feel right. In the end, the rascal wasn't caught by a genius profiler or a dramatic manhunt. He was caught the way most monsters are, by screwing up just enough to look suspicious on a random Tuesday. Soon, a victim who had escaped his grasp identified him in a lineup. Carol DeRonk had survived his attempt to abduct her from a shopping mall by fighting back when he tried to handcuff her in his car. While police strongly suspected the rascal was responsible for the string of disappearances and murders across multiple states, they lacked sufficient evidence to prosecute. The DeRonk kidnapping attempt was different. They had a living victim, a clear identification, and physical evidence courtesy of some hairs found in his vehicle. Her testimony would provide the first concrete link they could take to court. They figured that if they could convict him on kidnapping charges, they could at least get him off the streets while they continued building cases for the murders. The trial that followed became a media sensation. The rascal, ever the performer, chose to represent himself in court. He was his usual charming self, seemingly unable to commit the savage crimes described by prosecutors, and many observers found themselves strangely drawn to him, unable to reconcile his pleasant demeanor with the mounting evidence of his guilt. We'll never know how that trial would have ended, because in June 1977, as the case was still unfolding, the rascal managed a daring escape. He had been locked in the law library to do research, a perk he was granted for doing double duty as defendant and defense attorney. The guard, tasked to keep an eye on him, went outside for a smoke, so he did what any rascal would do. He jumped out a second-story window and walked away. He fled into the mountains, stole a car, and managed to stay on the lam for 6 days before a deputy pulled him over for weaving in the road. In December of that same year, he escaped again. He had managed to hoist himself into a hole in his cell ceiling, allowing him to crawl to freedom through the ducts. By the time the guards discovered he was missing, the rascal was already hundreds of miles away, heading south toward a final act of violence that would cement his place in criminal history. As I'm sure most of you have guessed by now, he surfaced in Tallahassee, Florida, near the Florida State University campus. On January 15, 1978, around 3 a.m., he entered the Chi Omega sorority house through a door with a faulty lock. In the span of 15 minutes, he attacked four young women as they slept, killing two and severely injuring the others. The savagery was unprecedented. He used a piece of wood as a club, bit one victim, and left bite marks that would later be used as evidence against him. After fleeing the sorority house, he broke into another apartment nearby and attacked a fifth victim, leaving her alive but with permanent disabilities. 3 weeks later, he committed what would be his final known murder. 12-year-old Kimberly Leach was abducted from her junior high school in Lake City, Florida. Her body was found inside an abandoned shed 2 months later. On February 15, 1978, a Pensacola police officer pulled over a stolen Volkswagen in the early morning hours. The driver was aggressive, combative, nothing like the polite young man who had charmed his way through life for so many years. When they finally identified him, authorities realized they had captured one of the most wanted fugitives in America. The final trial in Florida was a spectacle unlike any before it. Television cameras captured every moment as the rascal continued his performance, cross-examining witnesses, delivering his own opening statement, maintaining his innocence even as the evidence mounted against him. The bite mark analysis was particularly devastating. Forensic odontologists testified that the teeth marks on one victim matched his dental impressions with scientific precision. As an aside for the record, that evidence was as damning as it was bullshit. Forensic odontology has fallen apart in the intervening years. Luckily, in this case, thanks to dozens of hours of 11th-hour confessions, we know the jury got it right in the end. Ted Bundy was found guilty on all counts and sentenced to Florida's ultimate punishment, death. Officials didn't bother trying him for the myriad other murders and assaults he was suspected of committing. He'd proven mighty slippery in Colorado, and no one wanted to risk him escaping justice. Besides, it seemed an unnecessary expense when he was already scheduled to die. On January 24, 1989, after a decade of appeals and delays, the man the world knew as a monster, the same man who had struck Sybil Ferris as nothing more than a lovable rascal just 22 years prior, was executed in Florida's electric chair. In his final hours, he admitted to 30 murders across 7 states. But perhaps most chilling was what these confessions revealed about his psychology. FBI behavioral analyst William Hagmeier said that when Bundy attacked, he felt as though he was totally possessing his victims. Bundy told Hagmeier, quote, "Murder is not just a crime of lust or violence. It becomes possession. They are part of you. You two are forever one. And the grounds where you kill them or leave them become sacred to you, and you will always be drawn back to them," end quote. Bundy also told Hagmeier he considered himself an amateur in his early years before moving into what he called his prime or predator phase. That, he said, began about the time of Linda Healy's murder in 1974. Though he never explicitly admitted to having murdered before Linda, who's generally considered his first kill, his wording implies there had been others before her. In hindsight, Louise Bundy's words to Sybil Ferris decades earlier had proven prophetic in ways no one could have imagined. She had said, "He's a stranger around here." He had indeed been a stranger, not just to his mother, but to human empathy itself.
To
To research this case, I drew primarily from Ann Rule's The Stranger Beside Me, as well as Seattle Police Department investigative files from 1974 to 1975 containing witness interviews. Additional sources included Stephen Michaud and Hugh Ainsworth's Ted Bundy, Conversations with a Killer for biographical details, FBI behavioral analyst William Hagmeier's interviews with Bundy about his criminal evolution, survivor testimonies from Karen Sparks and Carol DeRonk, and court records and trial transcripts documenting his arrests and final confessions. The Catalyst is a production of Grab Bag Collab, a division of Just Us Media. It's written and narrated by me, Amber Hunt, and edited, engineered, and produced by Amanda Rossman.